Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress with another Word Balloon Extra program. Today, music historian Jeff Marcus joins us. He's the author of two books about classic picture sleeves for 45 records. Remember 45s? Volume 1 covers the 50s and 60s. Volume 2, the 70s and 80s. Now, Jeff is a veteran radio host and record collector, and his books present an interesting perspective on the history of popular music. I think there's a kinship from today's image and self-published comic book creators and yesterday's mom-and-pop record labels that operated out of their garages and cranked out many one-hit wonders that we all take for granted these days. We talk about the history of Top 40 radio as told through the picture sleeves of the different eras in Jeff's two books. My first question to Jeff was, how did the project get started?
Well, it started really about 10 years ago. I actually had a publisher in New York that was all ready to do it. We had a contract, and it was all ready to be signed, and before I agreed to sign it, he wanted to interject some additional material to the subject, and it became more of like, let's tie in headlines, sports information, and sort of like a giant time capsule book, which is something at that time I wasn't wanting to do, and I felt it was going to lose scope of the music edge when you start bringing all these other components into it. So I wanted it to stay simple. The best feedback I've gotten so far is how people didn't expect it to be what it turned out to be when they started to read it. It really does encompass a lot of different criteria. It's a great history book, but it's not a dull, boring, dry read. It's done in a very conversational, light tone. There hasn't been a person that's gotten them that says they haven't learned something from them. And yet it will appeal to collectors, yet it's really not a collector book. I didn't want to put prices to anything because that fluctuates with the market.
Sure.
And we put the rarity scale in there to let you know how common or rare it would be to find the particular example. But it really is a mixture of a collectible book, a coffee table picture book, and a pop and rock pop culture history book all combined.
What is it about these specific kind of picture sleeves that interested you to make up the selections that you have in the books?
Well, the sleeves that are in the books came from a number of different criteria. First of all, there are legendary people that I wanted to include, people that everybody would basically know or certainly have heard of. Then I also wanted it to be a book where it's just not the same people that appear in every rock history book that you see. There's quite a few people, for good reason or not, that get left out of other history books. And I wanted to put some mediocre artists in there because they obviously sold and hit a nerve at the time they were popular. Milli Vanilli comes to mind.
Sure.
And I also wanted to put some of the more ridiculous things in there, the novelty acts, if you will, that had a fleeting moment. And I wanted the book to be a big, oh, yeah, I remember that, or I had that, or, man, I totally forgot about that one, or why did I actually like that garbage? So I wanted it to prompt all those different responses versus just, well, let's put Elvis, Chuck Berry, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, Billy Joel, Elton John, the standards, if you will.
Now, to put it in perspective, picture sleeves were created to sell 45s, and looking at the history of the 45, it started in 1949. RCA Records released it, and better sound quality and more durability than the 10-inch 78 RPMs. And then really it's an interesting time because about 4 or 5 years later, the way popular music was gauged nationally was that show Your Hit Parade. And it seems it's kind of interesting that I think, given where your focus is, and I know there were picture sleeves maybe before where you start your books, but it really is rock and roll that kind of changed music in the performance being as important as the song itself. Like, Your Hit Parade was around for 20 years and doing popular songs, but it was just, you know, generic big band on there playing whatever the popular song was, and you could get any crooner to really sing a song. And even reading about Your Hit Parade, it sounded like 1955 when their crooners would try to sing Hound Dog. It obviously didn't have the same sizzle that it did when Elvis Presley was singing the song.
Right, right. And there was also another reason for that. The country was very segregated at that time still, and a lot of mainstream radio stations wouldn't play what was known as race records. So they had gotten people like Pat Boone or Ricky Nelson to cover R&B artists like Fats Domino and Little Richard and cover those songs, and they were basically blander versions, to say the least.
It was interesting, though, how many 50s and early 60s sleeves that you have in your collection that do feature black stars. And are these on lesser labels? Or, you know, I mean, obviously there were people like Chuck Berry and Little Richard whose popularity just, you know, you couldn't deny them their attention. And really, again, picture sleeves, because you had the occasional movies here and there, and television was certainly starting to happen. But really, this was the main media to kind of expose these stars. And I was surprised at how many black people, you know, did still manage to get picture sleeves during this period.
Yeah, there are quite a few, not as many as people may think. Some of the more mainstream ones, like you mentioned, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, certainly, the Platters, they were another mainstream group that crossed over. But there's a lot of doo-wop groups that never had any. A lot of the smaller independent labels didn't spend the money and didn't think there was really that big of a market to help push sales by creating the sleeves, and a lot of those groups never had them. So when you're talking about black performers, for the most part, a lot of the sleeves that were issued during the mid-50s were the bigger names that crossed over. Several of them were on bigger labels. Platters were on Mercury, for example, and they had, you know, a bigger budget, certainly, to sink into marketing than an independent label.
It was neat, though, to look at when your Ray Charles entry, and it was so shocking to see that it took to the 80s before Ray Charles had a picture sleeve. I remember there's a great postcard of that has a photograph of him and Sinatra in like 1960 in a recording studio, and it's like the face of popular music from 1960, and it's so interesting because he was so huge and a mainstream, you know, act and everything, and yet no picture sleeves for Ray Charles until Baby Grand with him and Billy Joel.
Yeah, he is a rare exception. You're right. None of his classic Atlantic songs had a sleeve, and certainly none over at ABC Paramount, where he started getting into Georgia on My Mind and I Can't Stop Loving You. None of those songs had a sleeve. In fact, out of all of his records, and there were tons of them that charted, high or low, there's only one sleeve issued, and that was the duet he did with Billy Joel for Baby Grand.
Pretty weird. Now,
very weird.
And you
sometimes
know,
there's no explanation as to why that happened. Sometimes it just does. Sometimes a particular label thinks an artist is selling well enough where they don't really need it, but then you've got the biggest band on the planet, the Beatles, and they had basically every one of their hits had a sleeve issued with it. So it's just one of those weird things, I think.
Well, and imaging was so important to the Beatles as well, and you have this amazing collection. I mean, again, we're friends, so I've seen examples of a lot of what's in your book. I know that you've added to it since the last time we saw each other, but there's a lot of really neat Beatle picture sleeves and things that I don't think you normally see in the usual retrospectives, whether they're video or even in books. And I think your section on the Beatles and their solo stuff is a good contribution.
Well, thanks. No, I agree. I know that I Want to Hold Your Hand was a huge sleeve, and it's one of those images that appear in a lot of rock periodicals when they use picture sleeves to illustrate the book. And I really wanted to do something different instead of putting just the same old on there. Now, I do have that sleeve in there, of course, but there's a reason for it. There was a very rare example. It's called the WMCA Good Guy sleeve, and it's probably the rarest sleeve in the book. A recent copy of it just sold 2 weeks ago for $22,000.
Wow.
And it basically came about, Capitol Records had made 1,000 copies of this jacket to give to WMCA in appreciation for playing I Want to Hold Your Hand the day it was released. And these sleeves were given away as promotional items to people that would call in on the station. Now, one side of the jacket had the familiar Beatles image that was on the commercial sleeve, and the other side of it had all the pictures and names of the WMCA New York DJs, known as the Good Guys at the time. And there's only about 200 of them, I think, that still exist today, but there's maybe only 1% of those fall in a near mint category, and they sell for big money.
That's insane. And it was interesting. Yeah, you rate the rarity of a lot of these sleeves. Are sleeves that easy to come by? I mean, comics is a collector's market, and you know, I know there are obviously music conventions, but you know, where does you know, there are stores, at least there are specialty stores that comic book fans can go to and look for back issues. Is how what kind of market is it for picture sleeves?
Well, there's definitely a big market for it. I mean, there's price guides, you know, out there, not recent ones, they're dated, but there's price guides out there just for sleeves. And you can find them online, eBay.
Sure.
There's people that, you know, sell them as a business. They are in secondhand record stores and places like that.
But how many secondhand record stores are there these days? That's another
question. Yeah, there's not as many. You have to be in bigger cities primarily, I think, to still find them.
You know, you acknowledge a bunch of them in the foreword of your book, and, you know, they're my old joints, too. And it's funny, comic books are facing a similar situation where, especially for me growing up, I don't know how much of a comic book fan you were as a kid, but, you know, you could browse record stores, obviously, and you talk about those memories doing it in Chicago and in the suburbs of Chicago. And the same goes for comics. And comics are just about 10 years, I'd say, in front of record stores in terms of still existing. But yeah, you know, the vinyl stores and the secondhand stores and even just mom and pop record stores in general they used to be able to go to for new stuff, you know, that's a dinosaur. God, I can't imagine any that exist beyond big cities, like you say.
Right. Yeah, I think the internet, eBay in particular, probably killed a lot of that.
Well, and also now digital music. You know, I mean,
right.
That's the other thing too. So
these mom and pop places couldn't afford the rent to stay in business.
Right. And I guess the same goes going back to the history of record sleeves, too. These smaller labels couldn't really, as you say, afford the big publicity, you know, side of the machine to have slick looking picture sleeves the way that the major labels did or even the major studios.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you think about it, for those that don't realize how simple the business really was in a lot of cases compared to these major conglomerates, which own everything now. In fact, Universal owns Motown at this point. People literally ran these labels from their garage. I mean, Herb Alpert, who now is legendary for being the A in the A&M Records, and his partner Jerry Moss, they ran A&M Records and recorded The Lonely Bull, which was the Tijuana Brass's first hit and the label's first hit, in the garage. Jan and Dean did the same thing. They had a reel-to-reel tape player, and literally recorded those songs, those demos, which became the actual hits, in their home garage.
Yeah, you know, did you see about a year ago, American Masters on public television did a history of Les Paul and talked about him, you know, kind of really creating the A-tracks and that he recorded a lot of his pre-rock and roll hits in his house and in various rooms where the acoustics were better, and he was kind of the guy that brought overdubbing into recording records.
Yeah, and Buddy Holly was known for going into Norman Petty's studio and recording stuff in the bathroom because of the different acoustical sound in there.
Yep, it sounded like you went into the bathroom for a second there to say that when you moved your telephone, but that's all right.
Did I?
No, that's okay. And that's another thing, you mentioned novelty records. We get a lot of tie-ins, not only for the pure sake of releasing picture sleeves, but again, back in this top 40 era of the 50s through the 70s, novelty songs could make it to the top 40 just as easily as a pop song.
Oh, yeah, they made it to number one in many cases.
Right, and even other genres as well. I mean, you know, you wouldn't think of hearing a country song on a hot hit station today, but really, yeah, Glenn Campbell was right there next to the Beatles and Dean Martin and, you know, I guess, yeah, even Mel Brooks, if a comedy song suddenly appeared.
Well, I think one of the wildest crossovers was The Witch Doctor, the David Seville novelty hit, which kind of, you know, was the birth of the Chipmunks, if you will.
Yep.
And that song was number one on pop and R&B, now, if you can imagine that. But that's the difference. You bring up a good point, and that's true. Top 40, basically through, I'd say, the mid-80s, was really a melting pot or a smorgasbord of a lot of different sounds, styles, and ethnicities. And you generally don't get that now. It's all pretty much the same kind of sound.
Radio's fragmentation has really hurt itself. And then, of course, the reluctance to play new music and new sounds has really hurt radio. And breaking records isn't done the way that it was
back
Yes, everything's labeled now, and one station will focus on a particular sound or style, and that's it. And that's pretty much all you hear on that station. That wasn't the case when we grew up.
Right. Well, you know, I do a lot of comic book interviews, and I couldn't help but notice and appreciated the fact that comics weren't denied in the picture sleeve books because
not at all.
You got a good hunk about the Archies in there, and that's kind of neat because two things about the Archies. Am I right? The Wrecking Crew provided the music for some of their songs.
Well, the Wrecking Crew wasn't necessarily a part of the Archies. But the Wrecking Crew is a separate entity, and we can talk about that. But the Archies was a fictional band. They didn't exist, obviously. They were created to market a Saturday morning cartoon show, not differently from what the Partridge Family or the Monkees were.
Sure.
Except they used actual people in the parts. Now, the Archies' music was all created and produced by Jeff Berry, who was a part of the Brill Building. And his writing partner there was Cynthia Weil, and they came up with a bunch of huge hits, you know, for Phil Spector acts and tons and tons of Brill Building artists in the 60s. And he was the mastermind, if you will, behind the production. And Ron Dante, who later would work with Barry Manilow, was the primary singer for the Archies. They were all session musicians, basically, that created the music for that particular group, if you will.
There was another pretty big name that was in the Archies, right? It was Andy Kim, wasn't it?
Andy Kim, right. He was actually a part of that session group of musicians. And, of course, Andy Kim had his own solo hit in 74 with Rock Me Gently, and he also had a couple of minor ones in the 60s.
Well, and Ron Dante was famous for Tracy.
Right. He had his offshoot studio group called the Cufflinks that had a number 9 hit with Tracy. That's right.
And if you listen to like Sugar Sugar and Tracy, you know, next to each other, you can hear the
very similar.
Yeah, definitely. Sugar Sugar was huge, and it's fun to see that song still pops up in movies today. And you mentioned that a lot about a lot of the songs in the book represented, not just in the case of the Archies.
Oh yeah, no, they'll use them in commercials or they'll use them in movies. It's amazing to me how a lot of these songs still have that longevity that a new generation will be discovering them because they can be licensed for, you know, a soundtrack. It's easier to take a song that exists and put it on your soundtrack than to write something new.
And
a lot of these songs, I think, are staying alive because they're being exposed to a whole new crop of people that may not have ever heard them before.
Sure. You mentioned Jeff Berry, and he was, like you say, part of that Brill Building of people like Carole King and Don Kirshner and Neil Diamond came from that, you know, setting as well. All of these bands, they would write these pop songs, and a lot of times these singers that were featured on a lot of the picture sleeves in your book would have these bands backing them up. And you mentioned two in particular, and one I alluded to when I was talking about the Archies, the Wrecking Crew. Talk about the Wrecking Crew. Who are they?
Well, the Wrecking Crew isn't actually the real band name. It sort of became a label that was hung on them. I do believe Hal Blaine, the primary drummer in that fold, started to call that fold the Wrecking Crew, and it just sort of stuck. But it wasn't something that they were actually known as the Wrecking Crew at the time. But, the Wrecking Crew was a crackerjack group of L.A. musicians that played on literally countless TV themes, movie themes, commercial jingles, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pop records. They were instrumental in giving that rich sound to the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds. They were hired by groups that actually did play as well, but needed additional instrumentation beyond the scope of what the band could provide.
And then there was, you mentioned the Funk Brothers from Motown. They were the session musicians that played a lot of the Motown hits.
Pretty much all of them, yeah.
And then from a singing standpoint, because another comic book connection, you mentioned you've got this weird-looking picture sleeve that came out about the time of the 1989 Batman film. And, Danny Elfman did all the music for that. But I guess to kind of hopefully, you know, latch onto the Batmania that's back in the late 80s, RCA re-releases Neil Hefti's television theme for Batman. And again, it's a weird thing because the singers on that song are the Ron Hicklin Singers. And they kind of were a vocal version of, like, the Wrecking Crew or the Funk Brothers, because they were tied to things like the Partridge Family and you know, things like that, correct?
Right. You had another spin on that, which was singers that did a lot of the background or actually did the singing for the fictitious groups. Now, in the case of the Partridge Family, you know, David Cassidy actually did sing the vocals, and his stepmother Shirley Jones did some background, but other singers, like what you just mentioned, would also be used to fill out that sound.
And they were, again, also getting material from those same songwriters, like Boyce and Hart and people like that had contributed to the Monkees in the past. It's funny how, you know, and we look at American Idol and the way music is manufactured today, it really is just kind of a rewrite, I guess, of what they were doing in the 60s in a lot of cases.
Yeah, there's definitely some similarities. I think you can go back to the beginning of popular music and find that.
True.
You know, you had your teen idols in the 50s, you know, which is no different than what you see today. You know, you had your Frankie Avalons and your Fabians in the 50s. And, you know, you had in the 70s, you had David Cassidy and Donny Osmond, which were probably the two biggest heartthrobs, you know, of the early part of the 70s. And when you really compare Donny Osmond to someone like Justin Bieber, there really isn't much of a difference. I mean, even the hairstyles copy.
That's true.
But, you know, that's really it. Their music is created for a specific segment. And you know it's not going to be a rock critic strong track. It's designed to be disposable for that particular point. And time will fleetingly remember it, but it's not going to be looked back on fondly like, you know, say a Rolling Stones song or something. It's a completely different zip code when you get right down to it.
No, and, you know, it's, I wonder, yeah, how much of this music will endure, because it just seems to me that Tony DeFranco wasn't given the front page status that a Justin Bieber or, you know, some of these other
flash in the pants are. Well, it's all different now. Media works differently, as you know, John. And now these people have their own PR agents. Back, you know, you mentioned the DeFrancos or a lot of those fleeting one-hit wonders. They didn't have a marketing team like the Jonas Brothers have, or
right,
a big powerhouse of Disney behind them to push them in everybody's face and actually make them more popular than they probably would have been based on their own artistic merit, because they're everywhere and they have the money, and people have gotten marketing savvy over the decades to be able to do that, whereas back in the 70s, you pretty much had Tiger Beat and 16 and those kind of things,
right,
which were outlets, but you didn't have YouTube where people could view your clip, you know, constantly throughout the day if they want to. All you had was the record to listen to over and over again.
Well, and, you know, now you mentioned YouTube. Let's take even a step further back, and that's when, you know, cable TV and specifically MTV came in, because I really think the mid-80s, there is this schism, and it's something we started to talk about off the air, and I made you stop because I want to talk about it on the air. You used as an example a song like Haircut 100, their song Love Plus One, which was a big video rotation song. It wasn't a big top 40 song. It's not a band that you included in your books, and I thought that was interesting. Go on, and let's talk about that for a second.
Well, I mean, the reason why they weren't in the book is they didn't have any sleeves produced, and that's really criteria. You know, you had to have a commercial sleeve issued to be in the book.
Well, sure.
Now, not every person that had a sleeve, of course, could make it. It'd be the size of three New York phone books. But we've got over 400 pages between the four decades, and you had to have a commercial sleeve to be part of the book. So that's why you won't find Led Zeppelin in there, because they didn't have a sleeve issued for any of their singles.
Huh. Well,
yeah, a lot of people are surprised at that. I'm still amazed at how many people have no idea that Stairway to Heaven, which is their most identifiable song,
sure,
was never released as a single. It was just one of those songs that got played on FM radio that became a classic rock staple, but it was never a top 40 song. The only thing that ever existed was a promo copy of the single that went out to radio stations. And I've got an actual picture of it in the second volume. It's very rare.
Again, though, going back to this schism between what was happening on Top 40 and what was happening in music videos. Now, you do, and obviously bands like Huey Lewis and the News crossed over very easily and started their success on music video and then became radio hits and then became Top 40 hits.
Right.
But there are some bands that, you know, probably were in the Hot 100 but never cracked the Top 40 per se. And yet I wonder, you know, I think some of their songs, at least based on films and commercial use and things like that, seem like they endured a lot better than, you know, whatever airplay they got on radio. Again, they had video play, and, you know, I don't know what the penetration comparison was. It's just all like I said, looking back, it's easy in hindsight to say, well, that should have been a big hit. It's surprising.
Right. A lot of people are surprised that old-time rock and roll was not a bigger charted hit when it first came out than people would think, because they hear it all the time now, whether it be on a classic rock station or it was included in the Risky Business
scene. Right.
And it was not a top 10 hit.
And then another, I like some of these weird success stories that kind of boomerang. And you mentioned John Cafferty in your book. And it was,
right.
You know, I mean, and that really, I remember that song coming and going as this Bruce Springsteen knockoff. But it was the Eddie and the Cruisers film coming on cable television that kind of brought the song back into prominence and threw it back into them giving it a second shot in Top 40 radio.
Yeah, they released that single initially, and it went nowhere. And it did get included on the soundtrack to Eddie and the Cruisers, and that's when it became a big hit. Another group that owes all their success, really, to MTV is Duran Duran. You know, they released Hungry Like the Wolf initially, and it didn't do anything. But when they made that promotional clip, and it was very visual and it was different for the time, MTV picked up on it. It ultimately went into heavy rotation there, and the song exploded.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think the introduction of what was first called the promotional clip and then eventually became the music video, they worked hand-in-hand in picture sleeves, and a lot of picture sleeves were inspired by videos once the MTV generation really took hold. But then I guess, obviously, the ultimate demise came, you know, with the compact disc, I suppose, right?
Oh, yeah. Vinyl took a big hit with CDs. I mean, they hung around for a few more years, but by the end of 1990, you know, vinyl was over, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, and now it's back, and it makes me laugh when I see kids getting into vinyl. And, you know, again, they've got to be, I think, fortunate enough to either live in a big city or have the disposable income to make it worth, you know, shopping online and everything. But it's I know a bunch of kids that are college kids and stuff and are very proud of their vinyl collection, and it makes me laugh.
Well, if you want to get, you know, technical and be, you know, talking audiophile, yeah, I think vinyl records sound better CDs, at least in rock and roll's case. I mean, you don't have that raw bass sound. CDs tend to be a little too sterile and compressed.
Yep.
And if you've got a decent turntable and you didn't use your vinyl disc for Frisbees, they're going to sound a lot better than CDs.
I don't know where analog sits in today's music world. I think convenience and the digital convenience is still going to, at the end of the day, be the way we get music served for the rest of the, you know.
Well, there's no question. I mean, you can't go back. The mainstream music listening audience is going to want their whole library on their little iPod handheld jukebox. They're not going to take the time to take one album and listen to a track or two, flip it over to listen to the other track that's on the other side. Yeah, it's a different programming. People's minds are programmed. This generation never did that. They never went to a record store, bought an album or a single, you know.
Now,
never did it.
I want to jump back and talk about one comedy act that you acknowledge, Cheech and Chong, because, yeah, there were always novelty songs and there were always you know, cute little comedian performances that would appear, but they really had the rock and roll sense in the 70s. And am I right? I think Lou Adler, a big record promoter, was responsible for them becoming, you know, radio and, more importantly, 45 stars as much as they were nightclub stars.
Right. Absolutely right. Yeah, they actually appeared on Adler's Ode Records label.
That's crazy. And I guess, you know, he really did kind of market it the same way that, you know, used to be done with with 45s in terms of really hitting the top radio stations. You mentioned that Beatles promotion in particular, and that really was kind of a good example of how records were promoted, where the A&R men, and you could talk about this probably better, but, you know, how they would really push to get a record on the air, and in some cases, you know, doing it in unlawful ways.
Well, unlawful is sort of an ambiguous term. There's a whole big scandal, and I talk about this in the book as well, that really shifted the sound of rock and roll for the worse for a period of time. You know, in the beginning, mid-50s basically, is when the rock and roll era technically took off.
Right.
And you had these raw performers, Jerry Lee Lewis, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Elvis, and there was this big payola scandal that rocked the industry. It was sort of like the McCarthy hearings of the rock music equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two primary DJ personalities that were in the forefront of that. Alan Freed, who self-proclaimed that he came up with the rock and roll term, and Dick Clark. Now, both of them were very instrumental in the music business. Alan Freed played what was known as race records at the time, and Dick Clark, of course, was a little bit more conservative. And at the end of the day, this investigation took place because people were saying, oh, well, these songs are becoming hits because of unfair practices. You know, they're paying money to get these songs on the air. And those things happen. There's no question about it. But what happened was it really rocked the industry. And most parents of teenagers in the 50s hated rock and roll. They hated it. They thought it was the devil's
sure.
music. It promoted sex. They wanted nothing to do with it. And this was a way to make it go away. So what happened was they replaced all of these original performers with these clean, safe, squeaky clean kids. And that's really where the teen idol phase came into popular music. We talked about some of the others earlier, you know, the Frankie Avalons and the Fabians, and Neil Sedaka mm-hmm. was another one, and Bobby V and Bobby Rydell. They were safe and bland. And rock music was pretty much over. In fact, during the early part of the 60s, other than some of the music that came from the Brill Building or the Four Seasons and the Beach Boys and Motown, you didn't really have much until the Beatles finally came and gave rock a good shot in the arm and brought it back again.
And, of course, all these British bands that came over were inspired by the R&B artists and a lot of those mid-50s artists that were squashed by the payola scandal in the first place.
It wasn't even so much that. You know, America really turned their back on a lot of these early performers, and Bill Haley is probably the best example I can give of that. You know, he had what's known as the iconic mainstream first big rock and roll hit, Rock Around the Clock, and in America, after a short time, he was pushed aside. And in the UK, he was like a god. I mean, there's footage of these British teens literally tearing that stadium apart in a frenzy over Bill Haley in the Comets. And it's disturbing and fascinating all at the same time.
Sure.
But what happened was, is groups like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles did grow up listening to those American records, those early to mid-50s R&B records. And they took that to heart, and they kept that in their sound. And that's what helped American listeners rediscover those people that have gotten lost.
Yeah, I remember. I remember seeing, I think it was on Ken Burns' Rock and Roll. Or no, Ken Burns didn't do the Rock and Roll documentary on PBS. But it was that original one that, God, it's tough to see these days. And I'm sure that clearance to get not only the music itself, but the footage they used back then must be impossible. But it's the Rolling Stones reintroducing Howling Wolf to, it's either an episode of Shindig or some American Bandstand-like show of the 60s. And they're like so polite to the host and saying, God, we want to thank you for letting us bring Howling Wolf on because, you know, audiences really need to know where this music came from. And there's
right,
Howling.
The Animals is another example.
Yes. And, I mean, that's the thing. This guy in his 60s belting out this great R&B song and stuff and kids really being excited by it. So, yeah, it's interesting the way things come back and how things are able to finally reach an audience. You know, there's something I just talked about this with a previous guest on Word Balloon. Interesting time right now with public domain. and it's affecting those early days of rock and roll? Because I'm hearing that a lot of European countries where the public domain laws and years are much shorter, a lot of this early rock and roll stuff, you know, pre-1955, but or around right around 1955, is starting to get packaged by music companies in European countries that are putting out these CD box sets and are able to do it because of their public domain laws.
Right.
Do you know about this? Are you know?
I know a little about it.
I don't know where that's going to go, and I understand that the bigger labels are probably fighting it.
I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are.
Well, and the sad thing is, and I hope that something is able to be worked out, those very same R&B artists are now going to start to become victimized by this because it really is their music. I mean, that's, you know, you talk about it in the books. That's where early rock and roll came from. And like you say, Bill Haley is one example. But what was your pick for the first rock and roll song?
My personal pick is Billy Ward and his Dominoes, 60 Minute Man.
Okay.
I consider that to be the first real rock and roll record, just based on the ingredients of what you normally deem to be in a rock and roll song. You know, it was very suggestive for the time. It still actually is when you break down the lyrics to it. And
being a 60-minute man,
it actually
absolutely
got any airplay back then on any station. So I think that really had all of the ingredients that became rock and roll. So I personally think that was the first song. Now, you can ask 20 different music historians, and they'll all tell you something different. There's no way to pinpoint what really was the first. There are several. You know, the Fat Man by Fats Domino,
sure,
in 1949 is considered to be one of the very first rock and roll songs. Elvis Presley's That's All Right from 1954. That's another one.
How about Rocket 88? That would be the, you know,
the Rocket 88. Yes, that's definitely, and I talk about that in the book as well, a very early example of one of the first rock and roll records.
And that's Ike Turner playing the piano on that. So I forget who the
Ike Turner was playing on that track. He was very, very young. Very, very young, but he was playing on that track.
That's the piano player on that. So I forget. Is it Jackie? I forget the guy's name who did Rocket 88. Jackie Brenson and the Delta Cats.
There's a handful of them. I don't think you can say this one is
sure. It.
But there were several of them that really, you know, the Crows, is another one that comes to my mind.
And Louis Prima's kind of a weird, like, crossover guy that's really more old Vegas and more... it's not bebop. I don't know. Maybe it is. No, it's not really bebop. I guess it's the end of swing. And
yeah, it had some swing, big band jazz ingredients in
yeah.
there.
But I know, like,
yes, and country and western and all those components
sure.
actually became rock and roll.
Right, and yeah, of course. I mean, you know, Elvis certainly brought as much country into his early sound as he did his the R&B stuff that he ended up covering.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, Elvis's best period, and he had a lengthy career on RCA, starting with Heartbreak Hotel. But if you listen to all the RCA discs, and most of them were product. I mean, they were created to sell, and they were a mainstream product.
Yeah.
But his original Sun record recordings are light years away from anything on RCA. I mean,
yeah,
these
that's the
songs
sizzle.
Were raw and passionate, and you listen to it, and it's an amazing thing. You could put yourself back in time and listening to that for the first time, picture yourself as Sam Phillips, who was the Sun Records owner. And he was just blown away by this guy. A lot of people thought when they heard those early Sun records that Elvis was black.
Sure. Now in addition to the books, the two books, you've got a website as well. Why don't you give us the website address?
The website is www.recordsleevebooks.com. And it does have sample pages from each of the decades for you to look at to get an idea of what the books actually are about. And you can order them right on the website.
And are they also available through Amazon and the like?
They will be eventually. Right
okay.
now, you know, it's a smaller publisher, so we have to do a few press runs before you can get a middleman like Amazon or Ingram, which distributes to the bookstores, because let's face it, they all take their cut as well.
Sure.
So we have to do several press runs for the publisher to be able to make the books more affordable to have a third party
I see.
Handle it.
Okay. Well, then primarily we'll send people to the website then. They'll be
right.
Right.
At this point, they can get them off my website. The delivery is very quick. If they place an order, I have them in next day's mail. They go out priority. They're packed very, very well, so they don't get dinged or anything on the way. They're very nice books, John. I got to say, I'm a tough critic, and I'm my own toughest, worst enemy, if you will. And I'm very happy with them. The covers are durable, and they're shiny and laminated. The pages are thick and glossy. Those sleeves look pristine clear, like they can just jump right off the page.
Well, that's terrific, and that's I think that's what people are looking for when they buy that kind of memorabilia book. And no, man, you know your stuff, and you're a good rock historian, and I think you're an excellent candidate to write these kinds of volumes. And I would say for people that are interested, check them out, check out the website. But I don't think you'll be disappointed in these fine collections of picture sleeves. So good luck, and thanks for playing. And when you do a comic book movie book, we'll talk to you again.
No, I appreciate you having me on.
That's Jeff Marcus. Check out his website, recordsleevebooks.com. And if you're looking for a great pop culture gift this holiday season, I'd say his books fit the bill. That'll do it for this episode of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. John Suntress reminding you that more episodes of Word Balloon are coming up before Christmas and right through the holidays, right through the end of the year. Because, like I said, I always think like entertainment kind of winds down during the holiday season. And to make up for it, we're going to crank out a few extra podcasts for you to enjoy, so you've got something to listen to as you're traveling to your holiday destinations. Hope you enjoy them. Hope you come back for another episode this week. Until next time, thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.